So, Jesus told this parable. This man and his wife were driving the man's 92-year-old mother-in-law down to her brother's funeral in a small town in Illinois. And on the way back from the funeral, mother-in-law was sitting in the front seat because she couldn't fit in the back seat. And the man stopped at a four-way stop, but didn't quite stop enough and didn't notice that there was a patrol car looking at him. And so he continued through the stop sign and saw some red lights in his rearview mirror. So he pulled over and rolled down his window, got his driver's license ready, and the officer came up to the car and he said, "Are you in a hurry this morning?" And the man looked at the officer and he said, "Well, I just took my 92-year-old mother-in-law to the funeral of her brother, her last remaining brother, and we have a long drive to get her home." At which point, the man's mother-in-law, who was sitting next to him, turned to him and said, "Are you trying to use me as an excuse to get out of a ticket?" So, isn't that just like a lot of the parables that Jesus tells? You read the parable and you say, "Okay, but what about this? Or what about this? How much of this do I need to do? How long does this last? All the important questions that you have, he doesn't address. And you have to actually think about them and talk about them and try and figure out what he really means. I mean, we discussed that at the beginning of this whole series in the parables, didn't we? That Jesus doesn't say everything, and sometimes the parables seem a little obscure and they're difficult to understand, and he purposely doesn't say everything. He doesn't spell it out exactly and say, "This is exactly how it is. And if you do this exactly, then you'll get exactly this result." He just doesn't do that. So, if anyone wants to know if that man in the parable this morning got a ticket, you'll just have to discuss it among yourselves at the table. So, did you guys hear what just this guy said over here? He was reminding us of that TV show, My Mother-in-Law, The Car. All right. This morning we've got the parable of the talents. And this parable is part of this talk of Jesus or this speech of Jesus known as the Olivet Discourse. So just if anyone ever says Olivet Discourse to you, you know that it's going to be in Matthew 24, 25, that area. And there's going to be some parables in there and some other things. And before I read the parable of the talents, I'm going to start out and I'm going to read some of the Olivet Discourse before that, which has to do with the topic for today. And in Matthew 24, verse 36, it says, Jesus says, "No one knows about that day or hour, not even the angels in heaven nor the Son, but only the Father. As it was in the days of Noah, so it will be at the coming of the Son of Man. For in the days before the flood, people were eating and drinking, marrying and giving in marriage, up to the day Noah entered the ark. And they knew nothing about what would happen until the flood came and took them all away. This is how it will be at the coming of the Son of Man. Two men will be in a field, one will be taken away and the other left. Two women will be grinding with a handmill, one will be taken and the other left. Therefore, keep watch, because you do not know on what day your Lord will come." So he's talking here about the second coming, But we also know, because we're all smart and we've read the Bible, that we also don't know what day the Lord might take our lives before he comes, because a lot of people lose their lives before he comes. So all of this applies to both of those times, when the Lord comes back, as well as when your day has come. But understand this, if the owner of the house had known at what time of night the thief was coming, he would have kept watch and would not have let his house be broken into. So you also must be ready, because the Son of Man will come at an hour when you do not expect him. Who then is the faithful and wise servant whom the master put in charge of his servants in his household to give them food at the proper time? It will be good for that servant whose master finds him doing so when he returns. I tell you the truth, he will put him in charge of all his possessions. But suppose that servant is wicked and says to himself, my master is staying away a long time, and he then begins to beat his fellow servants and to eat and drink with drunkards. The master of that servant will come on a day when he does not expect him and at an hour he is not aware of. He will cut him into pieces and assign him a place with the hypocrites, where there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth. Another thing that we know about Jesus in the parables and other times when he speaks is that he uses hyperbole a lot. Okay? Here, and hyperbole is kind of, you could say, a gross exaggeration, but for the purpose of making a point, not for the purpose of deceiving. So he says here, he will cut him to pieces. Okay, I'm thinking he doesn't actually mean he's going to take a sword and slice and dice. Okay? So, Jesus, that's a lot of stuff to say, you need to be ready, you don't know when the time is going to come. And yet, right after that, he follows it up with these three parables in Matthew 25. In a couple of weeks, Dennis is going to talk about the parable of the 10 virgins. I'm going to talk about the parable of the talents. And then there's a final parable, page 1, page 2, page 3, of the sheep and the goats. Now, there's before we get into the parable of the talents, there's a sort of a companion parable to the parable of the talents in Luke. It's not exactly the same scenario, but it's very close. It's called the parable of the 10 minas. And in this parable, I'm going to get to that one later. All right. So the parable of the talents starts out, again, it will be like. And so I thought, well, what does again mean and what does it mean? And so that's why when you read something and you really want to think about it, you usually want to go back to the stuff that was said before it. So we went back to chapter 24, which is before 25, to find out this background. And then now this, again, it will be like, we go back just a little bit to the previous parable, and the previous parable starts out, it says, at that time, the kingdom of heaven will be like. Now, if the next sentence were, again, it will be like, you would know that it's talking about this concept that's throughout the parables of the kingdom of heaven. So that's what we're talking about here. Again, it will be like a man going on a journey who calls his servants and entrusted his property to them. To one he gave $5 million of cash. To another, $2 million. And to another, $1 million, according to his ability. Then he went on his journey. Whose Bible verse has $5 million, $2 million, and $1 million in it? Raise your hand. Mike, yours has $5 million, $2 million, and $1 million? Okay. Anyone have $5 million, $2 million, and $1 million in theirs? Okay, I have a hand here, but I think that it's going to be a longer explanation than just yes. So, here's the deal. In biblical times, this is just like Bible trivia, but it's interesting and it helps to explain the story. In biblical times, a talent was a unit of weight. And it represented approximately 30 kilograms or 66 pounds. So what we're talking about here is 66 pounds of some kind of precious coin, gold, silver, whatever it happens to be. The word talent as we know it, you know, means kind of somebody's natural abilities that they've been endowed with, aptitudes, and something that we all, that word talent. Someone's really talented at this or talented at that. So in poking around the internet, I saw several places that said that the word talent, as we know it, didn't start to be used in the English language until about the year 1100. So when these people who were hearing this parable, and it's always important when you're looking at anything in the Bible to try to understand the context at that time, these people weren't hearing abilities or natural talents that we've been born with like we know. They were actually hearing cash. And the cash at the time, again, I found many places that said one talent was worth 20 years of a laborer's wage. Okay? So I did the conversion, and let's just talk about, for simple sake, a factory worker. And let's just, for today, pick a number, $50,000 a year. Okay? That's probably not far off. The company I used to work for, a manufacturing company, most of the guys maybe started at 35, but there were a lot of guys with overtime. They were making 60, 70 in the factory. So, and if you're a union worker, you're making more. So let's just pick 50,000. 20 years at 50,000. There we go. $1 million. So that's why we have the person who got the one talent got the $1 million. And everyone who was listening to this would have known that this was a huge sum of money that guy got. But the guy before him got $2 million, and the first guy in the sequence got $5 million. So in our minds, as we're listening to it, that is a lot of ka-ching. Some people read this, and when we go through and read it, they think that the guy who got the one talent was irritated because he got shortchanged. Okay? He got that day's equivalent of $1 million today. So maybe he did feel like he got shortchanged. Have you ever run across someone who made way more money than you do, or you did, and they complained about how much somebody else made more than them and that person didn't deserve it? So these are all the little things that you can take. There's so many things we're not going to get to about this parable of the talents, but one of them is that no matter how much God gives us, whether it's money or something else, we just have a natural tendency as humans to look to other people and be jealous of what they've got and feel like we got screwed. That's just who we are. And none of us is exempt. We all do it in different ways. So, back to the parable. So this guy gives out the money and he goes on a journey. And we pick it up in verse 16. The man who received the five talents, the $5 million, went at once and put his money to work and gained five more. Okay? So he turned his $5 million into $10 million. It doesn't say what he did with the money. It doesn't say how long it took him to double the money. It just says he doubled it. So also in verse 17, the one who had two talents gained two more. Again, no indication about what or how long. But the man who had received the one talent went off, dug a hole in the ground, and hid his master's money. After a long time, the master of the servants returned and settled accounts with them. The man who brought the five talents brought the other five and said, "Master, you entrusted me with five talents. See, I have gained five more." The master replied, "Well done, good and faithful servant. You have been faithful with a few things. I will put you in charge of many things. Come and share your master's happiness." The man with the two talents also came. "Master," he said, "you entrusted me with two talents. See, I have gained two more." Again, the master replied, "Well done, good and faithful servant. You have been faithful with a few things. I will put you in charge of many things. Come and share your master's happiness." Do we have any attorneys in the room? Sandy's not here today. Okay, we don't have any attorneys. He left. Stan's watching his granddaughter play volleyball this morning. After he made the coffee, good and faithful servant. Yes, all you guys who drink coffee, I'm sure you're glad that Stan came here first. And he's very dedicated in doing that. So there's another principle here that's talked about here, and it's talked about in many places of the Bible, and it's the legal concept of agency. Okay, I don't know if you've taken business law or if you were an attorney, you would be very familiar with this. So under this concept of agency, there's a principal and there's an agent. And the agent acts on behalf of the principal. And if the principal gives the agent money to take care of, to invest, whatever, for him, if you're the trustee of a trust, you're the agent of the creator of the trust. And you have to manage the money in the trust in a way that benefits the principal. You know that you're not the owner of the money. You're making decisions based on what you believe the best wishes of the creator of the trust are. That's what's going on here. There's another verse. I'm not great on quoting, you know, verse and scripture and chapter or whatever, but there's a place where I think Paul says, your bodies are not your own. You've been bought with a price. Same thing, this concept of agency. Our bodies are not ours to do with what we want. They belong to the principle. The principle is God. He owns our bodies. We have to do with our bodies according to what his wishes are, not according to what our wishes are. So that's this legal principle of agency, and it's in many places in the Old Testament and in the New Testament. It gets to this whole thing that we struggle with about giving up control of our lives to the Lord, and about us wanting to be in control and needing to be in control, and we're just not. But we think we are. Okay, so the first two guys doubled the money. And again, Jesus says to the second one also, "Well done, good and faithful servant. You have been faithful with a few things. I will put you in charge of many things. Come and share your master's happiness." Then the man who had received the one talent came. And again, this is the guy who got the $1 million. Doesn't tell us what he thought about how much money he has, but next it says, "Master," he said, "I knew that you are a hard man, harvesting where you have not sown and gathering where you have not scattered seed." I had no idea exactly what that little phrase meant. Harvesting where you have not sown and gathering where you have not scattered seed. I found one guy who addressed it, said something that seemed to make sense. Apparently back in the farming time that this was, everyone would have known what that meant. But even back then, the master of a farm or a big plantation or whatever, he didn't actually go out and sow the seed, did he? And he didn't actually go out and do the gathering or the harvesting. He had his servants do it for him. Okay, so I think that's maybe all that means is, I know you have other people do your work for you, but I know that you are a hard man. So I was afraid and went out and hid your talent in the ground. See, here's what belongs to you. So here's another lesson from this parable that, of so many different things, it talks about right here in these three guys how they view their master. Okay? So, and if you want to make an analogy to today and use this word follower of, the phrase follower of Jesus Christ, or even this other more catchy phrase that we use, believers, okay? That's what these three guys are. All three of them. They're servants of the master. And when we think of ourselves, we think of fellow Christians, we hear Paul talk about himself being a slave or a servant of Jesus Christ. So in our terminology today, these three guys would all be believers. The third guy says he was afraid of the master. You can interpret what that means. So he didn't want to disappoint the master, or he didn't want to get reamed out or yelled at, more likely, because maybe he wasn't as good at investing or in making money or being entrepreneurial or whatever. And so he just buried the money. He put it, in today's term, in a safety deposit box. Doesn't get interest. It just sits there. But unless the bank blows up and they have insurance, so it's going to be there. And he gives it back. Now, the master didn't like that, did he? He said, "You wicked and lazy servant. So you knew that I harvest where I have not sown and scatter where, and gather where I have not scattered seed, hey? Well then, you should have put my money on deposit with the bankers so that when I returned, I would have received it back with interest." So, Jesus says, "You wicked, lazy servant." Again, he's talking to, or the master says that he's talking to one of his followers. "You wicked, lazy servant." Then he says, "Take the talent from him and give it to the one who has 10 talents. For everyone who has will be given more, and he will have an abundance. Whoever does not have, even what he has will be taken from him. And throw the worthless servant outside into the darkness, where there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth." Now, if we go back to the beginning of this parable in verse 15, where it says he gave the 5 talents, the 2 talents, and the 1 talent, there's a clause there right after that, comma, each according to his ability. Here's another lesson from this parable. God doesn't give everyone the same things, the same abilities, the same maybe native intelligence or skills. He doesn't bless everyone the same way with their family situations. Some people are born into horrid family situations. Other people are raised in very loving families. Why is that? God knows. But it seems to imply that God, because he is perfectly just, takes all that into consideration when he evaluates our lives, when he gives us things to do, when he reveals his will to us and we feel it in our heads and in our hearts. I think this is what God wants me to do. There's a unique relationship between God and each one of you, and it is unlike any other relationship that has ever existed. It's just for you from God, based on exactly who God created you as and what he wants from you. And so in this parable, maybe the absolute magnitude of the money that these guys got isn't important. Maybe it's more important for us just to see that some were given more and some were given less, but knowing that God had perhaps less of an expectation of what he was going to get back from what he gave, but he still expected everyone. He expects every one of his followers to whom he entrusts with whatever he entrusts you with to do the best that you can given who you are. It might not be as good as that overachiever that always plagued you when you were in high school. It was the person who always got a higher grade on the test. His girlfriend was always better looking. He always had better clothes. He could shoot the basketball better than you were. He was the captain of the football team. You know, you were the water boy. It doesn't make any difference. God just wants you to make the best out of what he's given you, to wholeheartedly do the best. And I think for people who really understand God that way, they don't think about anything else. They don't think when they've been entrusted with something, oh gee, if God had given me more, I could have probably done this, but I only have this little bit, so I guess I'll make the best of it. That's the negative way of interpreting make the best of this situation. The way God wants us to look at it, I think, is for us to have the attitude, okay, this is what God's given me. I'm going to make the best that I can out of whatever this is. It's hard sometimes. It's very hard. If you're an empathetic person and you look at someone else's life that's been very hard, you look at someone who just doesn't seem to have ever gotten a break, sometimes you wonder, is that fair, God? A lot of people question in even a worse way, and they ask God about themselves. Was it fair that this is how my life turned out? Was it fair that you only gave me this? Was it fair that my wife died so young? Was it fair that I lost my job? Was it fair that I got in this car accident? And I mean, those are questions, again, that believers who really have a close relationship with God don't ask most of the time. Sometimes we all ask those questions. There's even more here, but my time's up. So I didn't write individual personalized questions this time. I passed out these sheets, and again, there's more if you didn't get any. These are questions from the Serendipity Bible. Serendipity Bible is a great Bible to use, like for a small group home Bible study or whatever. It has all kinds of really good questions like this, and I read these questions, and they were so terrific, I thought, let's just go with these. So as I said in the email I sent to the table leaders, you don't have to race through all these questions. You don't have to start with question number one. Take a look at a question that you think might be interesting, which would be all the questions are interesting, and start talking about it. If the conversation seems to have been exhausted on that question, move on to another one. I think there's like 9 questions. Go as long as you need to. I mean, so anyway, thanks.